Okay, I call to order the House Committee on Education for the 11th of February, 2015. We've got the order of the agenda that we're going to be doing today, I did call to order, I gaveled you in, is we're going to talk about today, we're going to hear, we'll hear but not work the following bills, 2404, 2412, and 2677. We are going to carry over to a work session House Bill 2846, which is breakfast after the bill until Friday, probably Friday. We're just waiting on paperwork for this one. We'll have an informational hearing from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We'll have a public hearing on House Bills 2412, 20, as I said before, 2677, 2404, and then we'll have a work session on 2545 and a work session on 2661. Okay, so with that, I'll open an informational hearing on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Ms. Chamberlain.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vicki Chamberlain. I'm the director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I've been in this job for about 13 years. So I was asked to do an overview of the commission, so I'm delighted to do that. I'm going to do it speedily, since you have a lot of business.
Thank you.
So the commission does three things. They set the standards for the license, they set the standards for the licensure preparation programs, and then we sanction on the licenses. So we're pretty fundamentally like other licensure boards. So with that regard, it's really with an eye to public safety and making sure that educators are well prepared when they're teaching our kids. This is our mission: to establish, uphold, and enforce professional standards of excellence and communicate those standards to the public and educators for the benefit of Oregon students. Often mission statements don't refer to the kids, and we like to keep the kids in mind when policy is being considered. So the commission has goals. The first one has to do to make sure our higher ed programs meet extremely high standards. The second one is to make sure that we are paying attention to the dispositions that our educators are coming out with and that they're culturally competent. We want to provide timely services as an agency, which I know has, many of you have heard, has been a challenge. We had some significant budget cuts last session. Maintain clear rules and have high standards for professional conduct. And I think that the commission, the 17 people I serve, coming up on that, do an extremely well job, great job on that. So the commission is the oldest educator professional standards board in the nation. We were created in 1965, and then we were separated as an agency in 1973. So, 17 commissioners have been on there all this time. There are 8 teachers, 4 administrators, 2 from higher ed, 1 public, 1 private, and 3 public members. One of the public members has to be a school board member. So we have a pretty good balance in terms of the field representing the commission. They all have to be practicing if they're educators in higher ed, and they're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. There are 11 other boards like Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We have another bill in this session to rename the commission, the Professional Educator Standards Board. This is a name that's been on the commission since 65, and it's just not consistent with all the educators that are licensed. We have a significant number of people in our database. We have hundreds of thousands of people on microfilm and 150,000 on electric files. And I'm only the third director since the agency was created, which is a little unusual. Mm-hmm. Our sole source of funding is licensure and fingerprint fees. And we've never received general fund and or lottery fund for revenue. So something I want to show you here, we have about 60,000 educators. If you'll look here, the certified school nurses have been plus or minus 3 from 90 for the past 13 years. The school administrators have been plus or minus 50 from 4,500 for the past 13 years. But educators, the teachers themselves, are the ones that have taken the biggest drop. About 5 years ago, we had 64,000, and now we're down significantly. So this just shows you that representation in a different manner. But here's a story.
Mr. Chamberlain, could we go back to the last slide we had?
These are the types of licenses issued. So this previous slide that had the numbers, in a slide, this is how it looks. So you can see the teachers are the largest body of folks we license. And then the school counselors, school psychs, and school administrators, and school nurses are together less than 10,000.
Excuse me, Representative Frederick.
Yes, thank you. Let's make it very clear. These are the licensed teachers. They are not necessarily working teachers at this particular. They have a license.
Representative Fredericks, Chair Doherty, Representative Fredericks, that's absolutely accurate. I don't think I brought an employment slide, but since I've been working on the budget, right around 50% of the licensed I do have an employment slide. You want to go to that? There it is. All right. Before I get to that, I do want to show you, though, the significant drop in numbers we've had the last 5 years in terms of overall bodies. This is a report we take out of the school report card that's done by the Department of Education. So you can compare the total number of public employed folks, if you look at 13-14, was 28,000, as compared to the 60,000, almost 61,000 of licensees we have. What I can't tell you is what percentage of those folks who aren't working in the schools might be retired. But I can tell you that we did do some research, and 70% of the new graduates in the last 6 years did not get jobs in the public schools.
70%.
Our highest hiring year in those last 5 years was 30%. Last school year, 13-14, when we had a uptick in the state school fund and districts could hire more teachers, we saw an increase in volume. So there's quite a pool of newly prepared people who haven't at least gotten jobs in Oregon schools. And I hear anecdotally some of them have gone out of state, some of them are substituting, some of them are working as teacher assistants, and some of them have taken other jobs. But I don't know how to track that specifically.
Yet our school population of children has not gone down.
Correct. If you look here at the bottom, you'll see actually the growth has been not huge, but 7,000 statewide, about. One of the things that people don't realize that the commission does is we're not allowed legally to call it accreditation, but the commission does site visit reviews of licensure programs based on national standards. So the state adopted national standards. We require higher ed to produce data to show that they're tracking whether or not their candidates have quality, and a lot of people don't understand that. So, and I only have one FTE dedicated to this in my shop of 19 FTE. The total number of preparation programs is 19. The total number of colleges and universities in that is 18. So we have one alternative route program. Salem Kaiser School District is preparing school counselors. And that's the only unusual thing we have. So this is a representation of the list of preparation you have that programs in the state. The asterisk indicates that they're nationally accredited by NCATE, the National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Ed, which has now moved to CAPE, which is the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation. Try to stay away from acronyms. This is another story that I was trying to tell you in a different way. These are the number of teachers, just teachers, not other people, who have completed teacher prep in Oregon over the last several years. Look at the dramatic drop from 08-09, from 2258 to 1425. So without being able to give you hard data, I think we can predict that in a very short amount of time, if these folks who haven't gotten jobs or taking jobs elsewhere, we're going to see shortages that we have not had in the last 15 years. And another statistic that we don't have up there is about 45% of all the new people we prepare are elementary teachers.
Ms. Chamberlain, one, you may not have this information, but I know that the teacher, the fluctuation of hiring teachers would go like this, and part of it was is that the experienced teachers were leaving at age 58, at age whatever. Do you know if they are leaving the profession at a much later age?
Chair Doherty, I think that I don't have hardcore data, but I can tell you that 86% of our folks who were licensed prior to 1999 are employed in the public schools, which tells me by, you know, extrapolation that they are hanging on longer. And every time we have any kind of changes in the PERS law or PERS benefits, we see some impact, either an unexpected retention or an unexpected drop. I think right now people are waiting to find out the outcome of the lawsuit.
Well, and I think part of it, prior to 1999, there were early retirement benefits to encourage people to leave, and especially with medical insurance. And now at least my colleagues in the profession are staying till 65, 64, 65 because of medical benefits. So,
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, right, and they're also, they're my age, closer to Social Security, and then they can take a fuller retirement.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professional practice is the third bucket of work we do. The commission considers somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 to 80 cases, investigation reports every meeting, and the sanctions they can take is they can revoke a license, suspend it, do a public reproval, and then in 2009 the commission received the ability to do a private, a public reprimand, a private reproval, which is sort of like a diversion, allows them to do corrective action. And this is usually for folks who either have had a long career and have one-time action, and you really don't want to put a public mark on their license, mm-hmm. and or brand new teachers who sometimes don't use good judgment. But it's usually only conduct that would rise to a reprimand level. But the interesting thing is over the course of the time that I've been here, and this goes back to 2004, look at the growth in the numbers of complaints that we've had. And the biggest growth, it isn't shown here, has been in complaints from not school districts, what we call patrons, people in the community, has grown significantly. So that's it on discipline. And just very quickly, our major initiatives that we have this session, I mentioned the name change, but we've been working the last 2 years on redesigning the licensure system. The last time the commission redesigned it in the early 2000s, they didn't abolish the old one. So we have people who were licensed from 1965 to 99 mixed up with people who were licensed from 1999 to present. And then they changed the duties that people could do on the license, and it created this incredible amount of confusion. Our other bill, 2411, would allow us to abolish those old licenses, put everybody on the same license, and really make it more streamlined in the field. The commission is also in the process of implementing a teacher performance assessment for new candidates before they come out. And this is an assessment that is developed by Stanford and has requires outside review of our candidates' performance instead of having the university and the classroom teacher do it.
Okay. One thing I just want to say, you were mentioning House Bill 2411. It was sent to the wrong committee. And so it is on its way over here. So 2411, which was the one that you mentioned earlier, we will be hearing, but it's not here today.
Thank you. I moved it back. We're also one of the early recipients of a deal the legislature cut with NICUSA for Oregon.gov. They are actually working on an online application system for us, which will help us significantly with our backlogs. Right now, we have people open the mail, handle every single penny that comes into our office, about $4.5 million over a biennium, and touch every application and supporting documentation still by paper. And that should all be eliminated, hopefully, by December of this year. We have a fee increase, and then what's in this bill is major updates and changes to language. The other final thing would be to digitize the professional standards, and there we have actually public storage that we have to pay for to store these files.
Thank you.
That concludes my presentation.
Okay, are there any questions of Ms. Chamberlain? Representative McLean?
On the 2411 that's coming to us later, is, for example, when I got my license, you had to have, I had a triple major, so you could do speech, drama, English, and be hired to teach any of those three classes. For this generic?
We can't talk about 2411. It's just, are you asking her a question about a context in this bill?
Yeah, so I'm just asking what...
We're not in a bill yet. Go ahead.
So the question I would have would be the general license that you talked about. Is it just, say, like secondary teacher, elementary teacher?
No, it isn't. But I am prepared to go into gory detail, Representative McLean.
I thought it was simple. If it's inappropriate.
It's actually more complex answer.
And we'll be talking about actually 2412 in a minute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that was the updated terminology and current practices on statutory language.
I'll be happy to come talk to you.
It's fine.
Okay. About that.
Representative Reardon?
Thank you for coming today. I hope you didn't cover this when I was out, and I apologize for not being here. But what you mentioned, the backlog, and so if I apply to get a teaching license today, how long would it take to turn that around?
Right now, we, Representative Reardon, we are 20 weeks out issuing licenses. So when I was at the legislature 2 years ago, we were 20 days out. And we had to do a 30% cut in staff, and it's had a significant impact on our ability to process licenses.
Okay, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It says that you're going to remove requirements that superintendents of education service districts have additional certification. Can you explain what you're removing?
Yes, Chair Doherty, Representative Hack. About two sessions ago, a provision was put in there that education superintendents would have to receive this ESD superintendents would have to receive this extra certification. There are only 21 of them, and in order to do it, you have to have a provider like a university or a program who is willing to do that. We adopted the standards. Nobody stepped up to do it, and it's because they can't do it cost effectively. So they could certify all the current 20, and then they would certify as there's turnover. So there may be one a year, or there may be none a year, or three a year. So it was the lack of ability to deliver that. And my understanding was it was put in a bill at the last minute, and there never was any discussion on it. But
and we'll be talking about this one in just a minute, because 2412, after she has her presentation on TSPC, we will gavel in 2112. Or 2412, that might answer your questions. Okay, any other questions about TSPC or how it works or whatever? I appreciate this because it's... there's lots of different certifications and licenses. We used to be certified, now we're licensed. And TSPC has always done a very good job of going through, especially with qualifications, because we have higher standards than a whole lot of states when it comes to being licensed as an educator. So we appreciate that. So thank you very much. So with that, I will close the informational hearing on TSPC. And actually may not want to go too far, because I'm going to go through and open a public hearing on House Bill 2412. So, Richard, if you could read 2412.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2412 removes outdated provisions and updates terminology related to teachers. It removes the requirement that the superintendents of education service districts have additional certification. It eliminates certain requirements from becoming approved educator preparation provider or approved educator or an approved educator preparation program. It eliminates certain requirements for licensure of out-of-state applicants, and it renames the Minority Teacher Act of 1991 to the Educator Equity Act. It expands the scope of ACT to include post-secondary education.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Vicki Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. The bill was intended to be primarily housekeeping, as often happens with housekeeping bills, other issues come up. I have provided to the committee a section-by-section analysis of what the changes were intended to do, and I clearly don't intend to go through the bill section-by-section, but I would like to talk about the terminology. The current terminology for licensure preparation programs is educator preparation program. That is a major change in this bill. The Minority Teacher Act has been in TSPC statutes from its inception in the early 1990s, and the intent of those changes was to remove the word minority.
And all of this is on OLIS, so.
Yes, and so, and to insert the terms underrepresented and change the name of the Act to the Educator Equity Act, which is more consistent with actually the goals and intent of the Act. There is a proviso in there, however, that we believed had been aligned with the equity lens that we understand may have a fiscal impact, and so we'll be visiting that with a committee administrator in terms of whether it needs to come out. And that would be including community college and higher ed faculty in the reporting the numbers of underrepresented faculty they have. Up till now, it's been only for K-12. For the out-of-state teachers, we just took away some old language, but fundamentally what it says is they have to meet the same requirements that Oregon teachers have to meet within 2 years after they're licensed. In the past, it was 3 years, and nobody actually is licensed in Oregon from out-of-state unless they are able to show that they've completed a full teacher prep program, they have an unrestricted license from another state, and they pass the character question and criminal background check. So the standards are still very high for them. It's not a fundamental change. The proviso related to the superintendents, again, is it was nobody stepped up to do the certification. The commission can't themselves do the training or certification. It appears to not have been something that could be economically accomplished. So we just recommended that it be removed. I don't think the commission or the agency has strong feelings about whether it remains.
Okay. Any questions from Ms. Chamberlain on House Bill 2412? We are not moving the bill today.
I do.
Yes, Representative McLean.
This is a very long bill, right? It's got 37 pages. And so, you know, you can read it the first time, but when I read it, my thought was that there was something in there that I had written down that had to do with changing how teachers were filling out things. Is that true or not? I don't know. I mean, I'm
Madam
serious.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I don't.
Well, it was this is totally just language. It's nothing to do. I mean, it's totally just terminology. It has nothing to do with process. I guess that's a better question?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I guess without the specific section, I'm not sure that I can respond to it. The bill is extraordinarily long because when you change terms, they run throughout many, many statutes. And then as it turns out, some of our statutes overlap with OEIB, so there's a lot of replication of statutes that have different ending times. If you could find it,
I'll find it and I'll call or something. Perfect. But I really did. If it's just terminology that makes it updated, better, consistent, integrated terminology, that's one thing.
Well, and maybe just a clarification, because in OLIS, Ms. Chamberlain has a testimony for this bill, and it says specifically in the bill, and it talks about clarifying some disciplinary procedures. And like eliminating authority to fine districts for failure to do some things. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more in there than just terminology,
the presentation. That was it. That's the process. Yeah. There's process there.
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, and I apologize for not mentioning that. The commission has had the authority to fine school districts for having educators who were not licensed, properly licensed. And however, they haven't executed that authority since 1989. It would be an extreme process to do it. Right now, if an administrator intentionally hires somebody who's unlicensed, they may be sanctioned. If an educator intentionally works without a license, like all other licensure boards, they can be sanctioned. Having the fining provisions, all we ask is just, we might as well remove it. It hasn't been executed for 25 years.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? If other questions arise, we're going to kind of continue this, so we don't have to worry. But thank you very much for this. And with that, we have nobody else signed up for House Bill 2412. Does anyone want to speak on it? Okay, if not, I close the public hearing on 2412 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2677. Richard, if you could read the summary, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2677 requires the use of formative interim growth assessments. It establishes the standards for formative interim growth assessments to be used by school districts, and it declares an emergency effective 1st of July 2015.
Okay, thank you. With this, as you say, all the information is on OLIS, and some amendments have been for the committee. We're handing out, there's been an amendment to 2677, and we are getting it, but it's also on OLIS. So here we have Congresswoman Darlene Hooley and Lisa Nato. And how about Congresswoman Darlene Hooley and
Susan Wardell.
Yes.
And Kelly Goodrich.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Darlene Hooley, Congresswoman Darlene Hooley, and we're here representing NWEA, which is an Oregon company. It's a not-for-profit company, and it does different kinds of assessment than the high-stakes assessment. House Bill 2677 is about interim growth assessments, which is really all about helping the child learn and working with the teacher to identify where that child is and trying to bring that child up to grade level. This test is used to inform student instruction. It celebrates student successes. And with that, I just want to tell you what the bill is about. Next to me are two real experts. First of all, I'll introduce Susan Waddell, who has joined with NWEA. She has been a teacher, a principal, a superintendent, and knows more about this than anyone I know. Susan.
Darlene.
Thank you. Make sure you identify yourself for the record.
For the record, I'm Susan Waddell. I'm with NWEA, and I am a retired superintendent who has recently come to this position. I support House Bill 2677 because I believe it provides tools to help all kids learn. It helps teachers identify where a student is and how to implement certain strategies to help students learn and grow from wherever they are. I really think this legislation is important because it sets parameters around what a good quality interim assessment is, and it allows for the teachers and administrators who use it to know that they're using a valid assessment. There is an amendment, and I know that you have it, and the reason we ask for this amendment is because we wanted to clarify that we do not want this to in any way create a problem with local teacher-developed assessments, that teachers should be able to develop their own local formative assessments to be used in the classroom. This is around interim assessments that are at a three-times-a-year assessment period, and then they would be used from a required list that's developed by the Department of Education. And then I'd like Kelly Goodrich to talk with you. She is NWEA's Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy, and she works at the national level with assessments, and she has some really good information about assessments in general and specifically around interim assessments.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Doherty.
I'm going to pull the microphone. Oh. It doesn't have to be real close.
Okay.
But
thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, good afternoon. I'm really happy to be here to talk with you about House Bill 2677 and perhaps provide some context on interim assessment.
And if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Kelly Goodrich, and I'm the Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for Northwest Evaluation.
Thank you.
One really great thing about the role that I have is I get to work at the national, federal, and state level around helping teachers and kids make progress. A great thing about working at NWEA is that we are not-for-profit, and that means we reinvest any profit back into our products. Well, thank you. Sorry about that. We reinvest our profits back into product and research. And one of the I promise I won't go into detail, but one of the research activities we've done two times, and a third one will be coming out next year, is a national opinion survey on assessment perceptions. And this survey is given to teachers, administrators, and for the first time this year, believe it or not, ever in the world, actually, to students. And we asked students, teachers, and administrators what they thought, understand, and believe about assessment. And I'll cut to the chase for our conversation today, but it actually... The biggest message we got from teachers and students actually helped us name our study. It's called Make Assessment Matter. And teachers and students all agreed they actually like assessments. They have no problem with assessments as long as it's relevant to their learning and impacts the teaching and learning in the classroom. Pretty clear message. So I look forward to leave these for you if you're interested in learning more. But we take that message to heart. And we believe that every teacher deserves good data. And we also recognize that there's nothing more important in the classroom than a great teacher. So I've come to believe if a great teacher has good data, amazing things will happen in the classroom. I also believe that every student deserves good data. And what is good data? It means it's timely, it means it's actionable, and it means it's valid. And validity means it measures what it says it measures. It's also important to match the purpose of an assessment with the goals that you have for the data. House Bill 2677 will provide standards, high standards, for any interim assessment that's used in the state of Oregon. And that's really important because, frankly, not all interim assessments are created equal. And there's some things that you probably want to know about that. Interim assessments can be given at the judgment and time breaks as a district decides, but ideally it's in the fall, the beginning of the school year, so you can establish exactly where every student is. And it's ideal if it's a computer adaptive assessment because you'll know where every child is, high achievers, low achievers, everyone in between. It also provides actionable data in the fall and the winter and the spring, and it helps teachers make decisions about differentiating instruction, creating small groups, figuring out what kids are ready for what next, and really helping them decide how to focus and change their instruction. But I also want to talk about the impact on students. Data from an interim growth assessment provides students with a different context for their own learning and their own control over their ability to move forward. Data can empower students if it provides them with the insight of where they are now and working with their teacher, determining what their next goal will be. Many students, over time, unfortunately, sort of lose faith in the fact that they actually have control over their abilities. And when you get growth data and a student finds out, I'm at 200 this year in math, and my teacher and I think I can be at 220, they start to learn that actually ability is not a fixed element. Ability can be improved by hard work, having a target, and supportive great teacher. And I think that's a really, really important element. The role of students in their own learning can be empowered by really good data and, of course, really great teachers. So I guess I'll sum up and answer any other questions if you have any around interim assessment. But I would say I hope that this bill helps in one of the many ways the Oregon Department of Education is moving forward this year to provide every teacher and every student in Oregon with good data. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Hack?
Madam Chair, thank you. So more assessments mean more testing. Mm-hmm. And my concern with that is teachers need to teach. Mm-hmm. They need to love to teach. And yes. students need to love to learn.
Yep.
And we continue to test and test. And when do teachers have time to just teach? Because I know data takes time to collect. It takes time to look at it. Mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of schools out there that have exercised the professional learning communities, and they're taking times to look at the testing that they're doing themselves, the teachers. You know, they teach a unit, and then they test on it, and then they look at the test scores that they have mm-hmm. just in teaching the units.
Certainly.
And they decide, you know, what they can do to better student learning, and they're talking amongst themselves about, you know, what are you doing that works and what can we do in our classroom sure. that makes it better. So to add more testing on to our students seems to be just overcoming of our teachers. Let's let them teach and let's let students learn and trust some of our teachers, I think. Mm-hmm. So to add more assessment and more data gathering, how do you believe that that's going to give teachers time to teach? I mean, common sense tells me that you need kids in chairs learning, and teachers are already overburdened with not having enough time now to teach students. How do you think that this is truly going to make a difference? And I mean, and we keep collecting data, and we're still 49th.
Yeah, no. Representative Hack, thank you for your question. It's a great question. I think I have a couple answers for that. I agree that the key to everything for students is letting the teacher teach. But an assessment, like an interim assessment, if it is computer-based, can be delivered in a pretty short time. And the results are automatic. The reports are automatic. So there's no gathering of data. The data is can be presented to the teacher and the student in a very simple, straightforward manner the next morning, next day. So I would suggest that data like this, it doesn't replace teacher assessment. It doesn't replace teacher teaching. It does and can provide teachers with a jump start to get a picture of where every kid is in the class. And it allows them to, as we talked about, break them into groups, differentiated instruction. And this is just really one moment in time. But the connection of those three moments over the year provides a really interesting growth trajectory. Mm-hmm. And teachers learn a lot about what they're doing. So it's... I think it is important that teachers and districts discern what assessments are the right assessments for their teachers and their students. I think that most teachers today spend about a third of their time using their own assessments or for, you know, our assessments that have been created by organizations. But I think assessment is frankly a natural part of teaching and learning, and I think sometimes if you can provide a teacher with fast, accurate data that allows them to track longitudinal performance and understanding of their students, I think that, to me, is a valuable use of their time.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. I don't really know where this fits into the universe of the testing that's already going on. I think I'm getting the feeling here that it is something additional, something that might be a bit more instantaneous. But is it possible, if we're going to even consider adding more testing, that some other testing has to go? It kind of reminds me of a pact that my wife and I have about our 2,400-square-foot little dream, and that is that if anybody brings something into the house, something's got to leave. And so my question is, can we approach this situation in the same way?
Madam Chairman and Representative Wilson, I like your plan about bringing something in and taking mm-hmm. something out. I think that's pretty closets. That works for closets too very well. I think that most states, including Oregon, are today reviewing their own assessment systems and their plans. And our own Congresswoman Bonamici has put forward a smart bill in Washington that would actually allow funding for states and districts to do actual audits of their assessment systems. Mm-hmm. And we applaud that because we think that there probably is too much testing and that there is some discernment of quality of data, timely, valid, actionable data for the classroom, and there is some discernment needed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Reardon.
Well, I just wanted to comment. You know, obviously this has been kind of a weak link in our testing system. We have we talked about the other day, we the emphasis has been on the summative assessments.
Mm-hmm.
They do a good job of telling how our, or some may debate this, but they give us some information about the system and how it's working.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and kind of a response here, this is a tool that helps automate the testing, the teaching process. It's, I don't see it as an addition.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers are constantly assessing, and they have to adjust their delivery. It's not the olden days where you had, you know, kids lined up in a row and they all did everything rote.
Mm-hmm.
It's individualized learning, and that takes a special tool to do that. And so we need to automate that. We need to make that as easy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So may I make a question on based on is the, to our knowledge, is the state getting into the business of developing these tests, or what's, and if so, what's NWEA's role in that?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, I have been working with Rob Saxon and Nancy Golden and talking with them about how we can streamline and make the system assessment in the state of Oregon more effective and use the time that we have for assessment and look at interim assessments as a tool, as you say, to actually get better responses. This legislation will set standards, and that's what's most important here. It's not saying we're going to add assessment. If we're going to do assessment, let's do it at a certain standard level. And let's make sure that the time that we use on those assessments is useful. And so, yes, we are working. This is right in line with the plan that was released this week by Dr. Golden, and we are hoping that we can support the efforts of the state.
Thank you.
I'm going to have I've got one quick clarification before we get to Representative Springer, then Representative McLean. And these are interim tests, so it's not like at the very end, you know, we've got the big long test with all of the things. It's to formulate maybe how the teacher needs to adapt things to to make sure that all these different children get it.
Yes.
Okay, so that's what it is. Okay. Go ahead.
Representative Doherty, it is also one of those tools that you can really, you can, it's assessments for learning. So you can group kids. If you've got fourth grade students and you've got four students that are at second grade math, you can group those students and work with those students and set goals for them. But it is not one of the high stakes tests that tell you, you know, you've got 35 or 55 or 95% of your students working at fourth grade level.
Mm-hmm.
This is all about helping inform instruction. So it is for the teacher, and I think it's a great tool for the teacher. It's used by 9 million students around the country, so it's not something new. It has it is not something that is mandated, but because they have found it helpful for the teachers, it is used. I mean, it has grown since the time I've been associated with it. It has grown tremendously because of what it does for the student.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
No. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if I quite understand what we're attempting to do yet in this bill. Are districts doing a fair amount of formative assessment now, and does it look similar to this?
Chair Doherty and Representative Springer, districts are doing different amounts of formative and interim assessment. There's a little bit of a difference between formative and interim. They both inform instruction, but formative assessment is meant to be on the day-to-day teacher doing the quiz, getting the feedback, changing instruction on a regular basis. The interim assessment is meant to be done three times a year, and so you can see growth, and then you can change your instructional practices, not necessarily to down to the individual student, but maybe to groups, as Congresswoman Hooley has referenced. Yes, there are districts that are using the assessment interim assessments that we provide. There are other districts that are using other interim assessments. What we're trying to do with this bill is identify which are interim assessments, what the standards are around those, so that the data that you do get from those assessments is valid and high quality, and so that you know that the data is actionable, as Kelly has said. Did that answer your question?
Follow-up?
Please.
Kind of. It helps get me there. So as I look at line, I lost it here. It talks about, line 23, subsection A, at the beginning, that shall be administered the formative, interim growth assessments, shall be administered at the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, and the end of the year. Mm-hmm. That feels pretty prescriptive, that we're not just adding a test, we're adding a test times three each year. Does this differ from what school districts are commonly doing, and would this cause school districts to change their tests or do something different than they are already doing?
I'm going to let Kelly handle it.
Okay. Madam Chairman, Representative Springer. It's actually in the district's hands how often they would use an interim assessment. The standards that are expressed in this bill suggest fall, winter, spring, because it allows enough instructional time between the assessing to get real accurate, useful data and information for the teacher and the students. So even in the bill, it says the district has a decision-making power when they want to issue or deliver these interim assessments to their students, but you want it to allow adequate instructional time in between. So when you have the 2 points, the fall and winter test, you can look at the growth of the student and see if they're on target, above target, or below target. Does that answer your question?
May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
So the next line then after that, line 25, is, or at regular intervals determined by each school district.
Right.
It strikes me as a little bit odd that we're stating these three specific times or at intervals that you want. So is it that open-ended? I'm trying to figure out what a school district is going to do or change when they sit down and they read this law.
Well, I think this law, Representative Springer, Madam Chairman, provides guidelines. Many organizations suggest 3 times a year because of instructional time frame. If a district wants to do it in the fall and in the spring, they would still gather growth insight for their teachers and students. So there is some flexibility on when they want to actually have the interim assessment utilized in their district. You need to have at least 2 data points to get growth.
True.
That makes sense? Yeah.
Are we going to discuss the amendment soon or at some point?
I don't know.
Okay. Susan, did you have something to tag on to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Springer. I'd just like to add that this doesn't require them to do these assessments in any sort of time frame. It's what's useful to the district and the students for growth, and that many districts are already doing a lot of these. This just sets the standard for when you do it, to make sure you have a quality assessment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have Representative McLean, Representative Wilson, and Representative Reardon.
If this passes and you are going to explain to a principal, a superintendent, or a department chair, okay, you have these standards. This is what you have to do in your formative and your interim assessments. What would you say that would be?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, first of all, I'd like to clarify that our amendment hopefully takes the formative assessments that are done day-to-day with teachers out of these requirements, because you would not be able to do the necessary formative assessments. So they, again, are going to make their own choice. And as a teacher, you know that a teacher has to have that flexibility in the classroom. What it does is, if you're going to use an interim assessment, that you know that it is of quality, that's going to give you a valid result.
What's the standard? What's the quality? I just want a list and or words.
Okay.
What is the quality?
They're in this bill, and they are a stable scale. read them as they're listed here. A stable scale that has been validated over time that measures students at and above grade levels to allow identification of appropriate instructional level and allows for interventions for teacher instruction and ensures fairness, and it's based on empirical basis and has sensitivity reviews. So those are the standards.
So my question is, what's new? What's new on that list? As you point out, there are, we already have most of those things in our formative as well as our interim, you know, tests. We do tests, you know, two or three times a year. We do performance tests. We do written tests. We do computerized tests. So the only thing I can see is new, and tell me if I'm reading this wrong, the only thing I can see is new is that you have to do it on a computer and you have to use a program that someone's either going to produce or buy.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I'm going to let Kelly address that too, but my take on it is it isn't new. It is just making sure that if you do use an interim assessment, it does meet these standards, and that the Department of Education will create a list that says these are qualified. These actually do meet the standard, instead of having an assessment purchased by a district that may not give the data results that the district can really use.
So the Department of Ed is going to read 198 different district interim standards, or we have to buy them from somebody? That's what I'm trying to get. Where's this list that they're making? What's that coming from? Is it from the district made test, or is it from people who create tests? Where does it come from?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, this would have to be a list that the Department of Education has put out a request for information on to make sure that these assessments meet standards. It would not go down to the district-generated tests. It would not talk about the common assessments that are developed in schools or across districts for formative education. This is an interim assessment that is developed probably by a nonprofit such as NWA or there are for-profit companies that develop these assessments as well. And they are, it is just important that we establish the standards, that anyone on that list is meeting those standards.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We almost got to what I wanted to ask, and that is that I don't really understand what the assessment product looks like, and I don't need an explanation, but is it a product that is purchased in all cases?
Yeah. Representative Wilson, Chair Doherty, it is a product that it could be developed by a teacher or an administrator in a district to measure student learning in that district. It also can be purchased. And the ability of a organization to develop perhaps a computer-based test, national norms to provide context, data that you can aggregate and use to compare your kids this year, last year, other kids. So there's features and capabilities that differentiate between a teacher-built or a district-built and then perhaps an organization-built interim assessment. But there are options, and most all of these features would really best be required by all of those. Actually,
if I could just quick follow up. So then if someone were to procure your product, then would there be an exchange of money there?
Yes, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Are we going to address, are we going to do the amendment? I'll explain in a minute. Okay. What they were asking is, are you guys going to address the amendment?
Do you want to speak to that briefly?
I don't have a copy of it in front of me.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
But before we do that, Representative Reardon had a question, and then we'll go to the amendment. And what it is actually Representative Comp is also involved in this, but she had an appointment that she had to go to in Portland, and so we're going to be carrying over and not gavel down on this, so she at least has an opportunity to talk about it also. So we'll get all of our questions out, and then we'll continue it. Representative Reardon.
I don't want to belabor this too much. I just want to make sure that I have the big picture. I'm reading this right up at the beginning here somewhere. It says this is a shall. It sounds like a mandate that districts shall perform these tests. They're going to be on three times a year, or they can flex that, but they're going to give some tests, which implies that they're going to buy products. I'm trying to get a feel for, if I'm on the right track, are we setting ourselves up for spending another few hundred million dollars down the road just a little ways? And that's what it, so I just want to understand.
Okay. Representative Reardon, Chair Daugherty, I think we might want to amend this to be permissive instead of the shall. Our intent is not to make districts go out and spend a lot of money on assessments. Our intent is really to make sure there is a standard for any assessments that are identified by the state. Yeah.
I think that'd be a good change. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, probably, yes, for you three ladies, maybe for staff. So I'm assuming there will be a fiscal impact statement here, not for school districts, because we don't do fiscal impact statements, yep, for school districts, but this does seem to be an added piece to ODE.
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, we have not yet requested or received a fiscal on this measure or on the amendment, in part because we're waiting on the amendment.
Yes.
So okay. We don't.
So there should be one then.
We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah. How's that? Okay. Other questions? Now we do have three other people signed up to speak. Are there any questions of the two ladies that were here? Because we have Lisa Nato, Morgan Allen, and Lorna Walker also signed up to speak on this. And are you going to be addressing the amendments or?
Were you addressing? I can briefly address them, yeah.
I don't
care. Does that answer your question, Representative Hack?
Yeah, I just have a question in regards to the amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, Alisa Nato with Julian Nato LLC, representing NWEA. And I want to thank you for the work that you're doing for education. Assessment policy is complicated, and it's a little daunting, especially for those of us who didn't particularly like the test. But there is an exciting opportunity this session, I believe, to chart a new course for our state with regarding assessment. We can move our state to adopt assessments for learning and to allow the teachers to differentiate instructions, have the information, so that the assessments can actually become a positive tool for learning that can really help not only the teachers but the parents and the students themselves. And really there's very little, very limited interim growth assessments in Oregon. While NWEA, for instance, has 9 million students that we work with around the country, there's relatively little in Oregon. So this is a new kind of concept, and it's hard to separate from the summative high-stakes assessments. It's a different goal, and that is to help learning and help student growth. There's no intent to be a mandate. This is not a funding bill or appropriation bill. This is a bill to set quality standards for where we do adopt growth assessments, that they meet certain quality standards. And as a practical matter, last session, there was a couple of million dollars appropriated out of the assessment budget to look at this new kind, well, not new, but to look at growth assessments and interim assessments instead of, to chart that course in Oregon. Those funds were distributed to the district level, which we believe is the appropriate place for these decisions to be made. And yet there were no parameters in the appropriation that came from the state around the quality of the assessments that should be, when it's state's funding, for the quality of the assessments to be provided to the district. So that was the need for the bill, just to give you that background. And the amendment, when we drafted the bill, the reason we use the word formative is because the definition, it's to inform instruction. That is the purpose of these assessments. And yet it has caused this confusion because, and I'm not an assessment wonk, but most people and even in the field understand formative assessments to mean those weekly, the assessments developed by teachers for learning, which we totally support and believe are also really important for the student learning and for the teachers. So there is confusion. We're trying to resolve that confusion in the amendment. We may need to work harder to get that confusion addressed, but we're willing to you work on it and do as much as it takes to get there.
Okay. President Pack, does that answer your question, or?
I just had, not necessarily, although I, for the record, I'm not against assessments. But my question was in regards to the, there's line 14 of the amendment. It talks about teacher-developed formative assessments. Line 15 says they can be locally developed assessments that are part of a system for collecting, manage, and managing collections of assessment items, or they can be developed in line 17 at the school level or the school district level, which is what districts now, I'm understanding, are doing. So who will you be monitoring those and saying these are an approved level of assessment? I guess I'm confused in if they're able to decide how they're going to do their own assessments, which they're doing now, are you going to step in and say this is an approved method of assessment, or are you still going to allow them to decide what they're doing? And if so, what really is the need for the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, those, and maybe we should talk about it additionally, but the intent is, of the amendment is that those specifically are not included in the definition of what the interim growth assessment is.
So they can't?
So that they would be outside of the parameters of this bill.
Follow up, please. So it says each school district shall use formative in line 7. Yeah. So it's saying that they can use those, and then it lists what they can do.
Well, we'll need to work on this amendment, Madam Chair, Representative Hack. Well, let's review this amendment. We just got it moments before.
Right. So. And I think just for process, what I'm going to do, we have two other people, Morgan Allen and Lorna Walker, that want to come up and speak if we have no other questions for these. And then what I'm going to do is, I say, carry over the hearing so we don't close it. And so there's time to answer the questions that deal with the amendment, and then you said there's possibly another amendment that you're talking about also. And so that way we can get it fully vetted as the bill and get the answer, the questions answered.
Thank you.
Okay?
Check
that we're going to do. So thank you very much. And Lisa, if you want to stay up.
Oh,
you were signed up also.
That was my testimony.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
So Morgan Allen and Lorna Walker.
It's just to test the children or the teachers.
Yes. Thank you very much. Make sure you identify yourself for the record. And it doesn't have to be real close. Me about that, to 12 inches away.
About there?
Perfect.
Excellent. Good afternoon. I'm Lorna Walker. I'm a retired educator, and I'm so delighted to be here with you today to talk to you a little bit about formative, interim, and summative assessment, and what the need for it is, why it's here. 30 years ago, formative, interim, and summative assessment was not common terminology among all educators in the United States or even in the Northwest. Doesn't mean that assessment didn't happen. There was assessment by teachers, and in some districts, there were evaluation and measurement departments that guided assessment in specific academic areas. And there was a national assessment. As the result of a lot of research and the innovative processes of education implemented by a huge number of educators devoting many hours and a vast wealth of knowledge and experience to the process, we came about developing a part of the infrastructure of the process of education. The process of education. Assessment is a part of that process. Now, the need for it is that it keeps a focus and it sets a benchmark standard that instead of just in one district in the state or in a group of schools in the state, certain benchmarks or standards have happened. It means that if we have a state assessment that happens on based upon our benchmarks, that sets a focus to the framework. Now, if you look at Bloom's taxonomy of critical thinking, we find that the process of education is the development of teaching the process of thinking. And it means we may teach the same thing several different times, but in different ways, using different kinds of skills and strategies. Now, if part of the students in the class have mastered a certain skill, and there's another group of students who really haven't, may only partially, or may even not yet have begun to understand, it means reteaching is involved. Now, as this process of formative, interim, and summative assessment was developed, what we find is that it takes huge numbers of hours to develop tests, whether you're a classroom teacher, whether you are an administrator supervising a group of teachers, or whether you are an evaluation department. It takes huge amounts of time, skill, and focus upon what the benchmarks are and how they are to become accomplished, what each of those little outcomes are, and keeping focused on each of those little outcomes, yet arriving at the end result. So when we look at assessment, we're looking at the development and implementation of a process. And this is just, assessment is just one little part of the educational process. But the value in it is that it allows us to redefine, redirect our planning. We make a plan, and then we teach, and then we assess. And there should be many different types of assessments. Students benefit from different types of assessments. They learn how to take tests. They learn how to respond. They learn how to express themselves. And it is affirming to them. They feel good when what they have accomplished has been affirmed. And so with the process of this going on, having that framework that sets a standard, not just in one classroom, but if we have that framework across the state, that frees up a huge amount of time for staff to be able to direct on some of the finer points of formative assessments, to redirect and accomplish a more refined level of teaching and learning. If you look at the results of evaluations over a duration of time, you will see that there has been a tremendous improvement in the outcomes. It takes huge amounts of effort to make just a little bit of improvement in the outcomes.
Okay. And Ms. Walker, we're running out of time, so I'll need to have you summarize, please.
I will not take much more of your time. But what I do want to affirm is that the process that you are engaging in addressing this bill, is really significantly important to education and to the state and to the success of our 40-40-20. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Ms. Walker? Okay, thank you. Ms. Morgan.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association, and just got a chance to look at the amendment as well, and I appreciate I've had a chance to talk to the sponsor and the proponents, and we do think there needs to be a little bit more clarity in the bill. I think we appreciate the intent of the bill, which is to basically say the Department of Education, if you're going to purchase commercially available testing products, that there's some sort of assurance that there someone has looked at them for quality. Mm-hmm. Maybe just like textbooks, that may be a way to look at it. So I think that's the direction it seems to us that the bill is trying to go. But I think we need some more clarity around, and the amendment seems to be trying to go that direction. It may not quite get there. I need to take a look. But the idea that locally created assessments by teachers and staff, or the tests that happen at the local level that are created and given at the local level, those are not impacted or reviewed or have to go through any sort of state review or ODE review. We certainly don't want that. And we want to maintain maximum flexibility for districts. I think the other thing that we might need to take a look at, too, and I mentioned this to the proponents, is there are a lot of districts that have already made significant investments in purchasing formative and interim assessment systems. And there's also always the possibility, if for the first time you're creating a list of what you can or cannot use, that someone may be using a product that is not on the new approved list. So we may need to address that. I could, just for example, Salem Kaiser, I know, has invested significant amounts of money in developing and purchasing formative and interim assessments. And so we want to make sure that if you have something that's already in the works, that that you can continue to use that. So I've talked to the Representative Comp and the proponents, and we look forward to working with them to try to smooth some of the rough edges out. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Brett.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I had one question. I'm just thinking as I'm listening about these tests, if they couldn't be twofold, to also evaluate the teachers also. I mean, one of the statements made was good teachers and good data, you know, give you that information. But I'm wondering if they're used to evaluate the teacher's ability also.
Chair Doherty and Representative Barreto, to be perfectly honest, I am not a testing expert, so I will see if I can maybe get someone from the Department of Ed to answer that question. I am certainly not qualified to.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Those were the only ones that we had signed up. Anybody else wanting to speak on this side of the page? 2677. Okay, with that, I'm not going to close the hearing. I'm going to carry over the hearing and keep the public hearing open so they can deal with issues, and that Representative Comp will have the opportunity to come in. Okay. Do I need to gavel with that?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2404. Heidi Dupuy. And Richard, if you could read what the bill is, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2404 adjusts school food and beverage nutritional standards to comply with federal food and beverage nutritional standards. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. There is one amendment, the -1 amendment, that we've been asked to consider that would make a small change to the bill. It would add seed butters to the list of exempted items from a saturated fat prohibition.
Okay, thank you. Dan McComb, Lisa Dupuy, or Heidi. Thank you. Did I call you Lisa? I meant Heidi.
No. Go ahead. For the record, Jan McComb with the Department of Education. With me is Heidi Dupuy, who is our manager of school nutrition programs. And there was an issue that was brought to Heidi's attention last spring, where some of the Oregon Smart Snacks standards didn't quite align up with the brand new federal standards. And so she tried to look at the bumpiest parts of where the misalignment was in response to districts' concerns and crafted House Bill 2404. And so I would just turn it over to Heidi now.
Hi. Chair and committee, just for some background, in 2000. I'm Heidi Dupuy with the Department of Education, Manager of School Nutrition Programs. So in 2007, the Oregon Legislature passed nutrition standards for food sold in schools to students outside of the school meals program. And in 2010, the federal government or the Congress gave the USDA authority to establish national standards for that same group of foods. And in 2014, those were published as an interim rule. And when the state standards and the federal standards came together, we had some differences. And what you see in the bill is not an exact reiteration of the federal standards, but keeping the Oregon standards in place and only addressing those places where we had rough spots between the two sets of legislation. And so specifically what was added was to allow beverages that are juices, 100% juice diluted with either carbonated or plain water, to allow calorie-free flavored water, and to align our beverage standards between the two bills or two laws, to allow seeds, nut butters, and now we've added through the Dash 1 amendment seed butters to exemption for total fat and saturated fat. And this allows students who are either have nut allergies or are vegetarian to expand their food choices that are available to them at school. And then for entree items that are being served on the National School Lunch Program, that they would be exempt from nutrition standards because they've already gone through meeting nutrition standards to be served as part of the National School Lunch Program. And finally, to address caffeine at the elementary and middle school levels.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, thank you. One quick question. Maybe just off track just a tiny bit, but have the menus changed in the schools in the last couple of years? The reason I ask is I had a conversation with my grandkids here in town over the weekend, and I'll just leave it at that. Okay. They made some very definitive statements about what they're eating these days.
Yeah.
So the question is, did something change a couple of years ago?
Sure.
Or something?
So, Chair Daugherty and Representative Wilson, yes, something changed, a big change. The Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010 really remodeled the National School Lunch and School Breakfast menus to, over a period of time, from 12 to our current school year, we serve all of our grain offerings are whole grain rich. That means they have to at least have a content of 50% whole grain in them. Also, the requirements for the volume of fruits and vegetables that are offered to students. And within the vegetable category, there's standards for red, orange, dark leafy greens, legumes, other vegetables, and additional vegetables. So they're seeing a much different offering.
Thank
and
you.
Composition.
Thank you. Many things are coming into focus now, so I appreciate that.
Representative, in other words, things are healthier than they were 3 years. Okay, thank you. Representative Reardon.
We also
have a bunch of about six others that want to speak.
I have to ask this for the sake of my friends who are still teaching. Is it the intent of this bill to prohibit teachers from being able to purchase a caffeinated coffee or Coca-Cola type product in their faculty room?
Chair Daugherty and Representative Reardon, I don't know that it's the intent of this bill to do that specifically, but the Oregon school nutrition standards apply to the entire school campus as opposed to an audience. So the bill doesn't change the audience. So in this case, because the Oregon school nutrition standards apply to the building and teachers that are in the building where they're students, then the same nutrition standards that apply to the students also apply to the teachers.
Well, did you intend to work this today?
Yes, a Representative Reardon follow-up question?
Would it be possible, could we adjust this some way to accommodate those hardworking teachers that really need their caffeine without destroying the integrity of this bill?
Grandkids need it too.
Okay.
They're on their own. But.
So
I'm pretty serious, actually.
Yeah. Chair Daugherty and Representative Reardon, I can think of at least three ways that the bill could be amended to accommodate your request. One is that the simplest one would be for prohibiting giving the exception for adults in elementary and middle schools for caffeinated.
And high schools, please.
Well, no, high school already has. It's only specifically limited, not sold in elementary and middle schools, but would be allowed in high schools. Okay. So you could specifically set aside caffeine in teachers. Okay. Would be one option.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be brief. My question almost got completely answered. We're talking about the Diet Coke in the teacher's lounge also, aren't we? Okay. And I don't remember the bill off the top of my head that we passed in the 08 session that talked about an exemption in the teacher's lounge. I have a hard time telling an adult dealing with kids all day. I have a hard time telling an adult what they can eat and drink. I really do.
So, Chair Daugherty and Vice Chair Representative Springer, that this is not telling an adult what they can eat or not eat. This is around what's available for sale at school. And so, and the for a diet.
So this does not prohibit what I can bring to school as an adult to eat.
Correct.
So I could bring like Cheetos and and. You know, pork rinds and all that kind of thing to eat for my lunch. And
yes.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification. That was the one I was going to make.
But we may want to
enough
look.
Said. Yeah. We're not moving this
at
bill.
At an exemption.
We're not moving this bill today,
no,
correct?
We're not.
So in that vein, enough said.
Those are the concerns that we have. Okay. Anything else to add quickly?
Add for further clarification, because I was learning all about this myself. And so federal law does not prohibit teachers from buying things in their lounge, and so if it pleased the panel to change that law, you could do so. This bill doesn't address that,
correct.
But you could do that through an amendment to this bill.
Okay, thank you. Okay, quickly, we're going to get somebody else in 7 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Daugherty. There were some issues. It seems like this last year on a federal level where the kids were throwing away more food than they were eating because it didn't taste good. They didn't like it. They threw it in the garbage can. Is that being monitored at all, or would that be monitored at all?
Chair Daugherty and Representative Barreto, that is not part of this legislation for monitoring the waste of students from the meals.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, anything else?
The individual schools have on occasion undertaken doing a waste study, which measures the amount of waste in the garbage cans. And that way, not only are school meals thrown away, but also meals that come from home are thrown away.
The Cheetos?
No, those apples and carrot sticks and celery sticks and whole grain bread and brown rice salads that parents dutifully make and put into their children's lunches because they're healthy.
They want the burritos.
Don't get eaten as well.
No, the Cheetos are not thrown away.
Yeah.
Brown rice. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, next we have Dave Harvey, Cynthia Henry, and Lynn Shore. And please keep your comments very, very brief. We have three other bills that we have to work today. So if you want to start, go ahead.
Chair Daugherty, members of the committee, I have given you, thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Dave Harvey, and I live here in Salem, and I'm a parent of two public school students, and I work in the school food service industry here in the Salem area. As a parent and professional in the school food industry, I am the support of House Bill 2404 that makes minor changes that aligns the state of Oregon's nutrition standards with the new USDA standards. In particular, exempting entrees from calorie and fat restrictions that are also sold as reimbursable meals. Exempting these entrees sends a consistent nutrition message about school meals that they are already fit into a balanced and nutritionally sound meal and represents a healthy choice for students who do not want a whole reimbursable meal. Let me give you an example. We offer burritos made to order. And a burrito that a typical student would take is a 10-inch whole grain flour tortilla, 2 ounces of reduced fat, reduced sodium taco meat, vegetarian refried beans, shredded cheese, which is also reduced fat, a little lettuce, only 1 tablespoon of sour cream, olives, onions, and salsa at 478 calories. Selling that would be not allowable under the current conditions, and yet it's a reimbursable meal sold as an entree, as a meal. And so what we're asking for is the balanced approach mitigates potential confusion among parents, students, and staff of the schools that that a particular entree item is healthy when sold as part of a reimbursable meal and sold individually. Study shows that foods are more nutrient dense than ones brought from home, especially purchased from local restaurants, which they do go out, those high schoolers do go out on campus and purchase. We should not be putting up barriers in front of students that prevent them from purchasing something healthy. I urge you to keep the entree exempt language in House Bill 2404. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next.
Chair Doherty and committee. I'm Cindy Hyatt-Henry. I'm food service director at McMinnville School District. And I would echo what Mr. Harvey says and add that limiting what we are able to sell to our students adds another potential financial burden to districts who are already limited above and beyond what was happening many, many years ago. We are required, or at least expected, to break even in our programs, and there's a limited number of districts who are able to break even now, and limiting what we can sell could potentially add to that burden. We don't want to take away from educational dollars, and if we don't break even in our child nutrition programs, the general fund has to supplement our programs. So I would urge that we would pass this bill with these amendments.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Shore. I represent the Oregon School Nutrition Association. I'm their legislative chair. Oregon School Nutrition Association has 449 members that consist of school nutrition professionals. These people are on the front line feeding Oregon's kids healthy meals and doing a great job of interpreting and implementing all of those new and sometimes confusing state and federal guidelines that we've been talking about. We support the original language in House Bill 2404 on page 3 and lines 8 through 14 specifically about entrees. The language in the bill around entree exemption mirrors the federal Smart Snacks exemption for entrees on the day served and the day after. Combining the Smart Snack entree rules with the current 450 calorie, 36% fat limit already limits the sales of most of our popular food items. Sometimes a student just doesn't want or can't afford a whole meal, so they purchase the entree. Sometimes all a person wants for lunch is a sandwich or a salad. The entree salads that were provided to you by the Salem-Keizer School District last Friday, for instance. We are not talking about greasy store-bought pizzas here. We're talking about items that have been specifically formulated for schools, and they're lower in fats and made with whole grains and are low in sodium, as the burrito he was talking about. Most of our schools serve entrees that are an assemble and serve type of an item, like a sandwich. They are very appetizing, and we can control the ingredients. Again, we support the original language in House Bill 2404 on page 3, lines 8 through 14. Please leave it to the local school district's local wellness committees to exercise the option of making these stricter if they please.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. We have Sarah Higginbotham and Cassandra Griffin. And if you have anything additional to add or whatever, we are, as usual, under a time crunch. So thank you. Go ahead and start.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, hello. My name is Cassandra Griffin. I'm with Upstream Public Health. We're a statewide public health advocacy organization. We believe that school food is a really important cornerstone of health, and so we have worked a lot on this issue over the years. It was one of the first things we worked on when the organization was getting founded, was passing what is the basis, the underlayer of what you're looking at right now, House Bill 2650 in 2007, setting these competitive food standards. So Oregon in 2007 passed these strong standards for what can be sold in schools outside of the federal school meals standard, and we passed stronger standards than were in place most places. We feel proud of that, and we want to keep those largely in place. The legislation we're looking at right now modifies those in reaction to some federal legislation in ways that we mostly support. We feel fine about the seed and nut butters. We feel fine about diluted juice. We feel fine about the calories. We also would feel fine about a modification of the faculty drinking whatever beverages they want. But the item that we are concerned about is a relaxation of calorie and fat standards for entree items sold alone. That's what Ms. Shore was just referring to. You have in front of you dash two amendments that propose to take out a few lines. You don't have in front of you?
We have on OLUS a dash two.
Thank you.
There was something.
Oh, no, never mind. We don't have the amendment. We don't have the amendment.
That's our fault, not yours.
Okay. Apologies. We thought that you were going to have a dash two amendment in front of you.
We don't.
Which would, on page three, strike lines 8 through 14, which exempt certain entree items from calorie and fat limits. With that amendment, which you don't have in front of you, we would fully support this bill. We support all the other items in it. Without that amendment, we would request that you delay, which it sounds like you're going to do anyway, so that we can continue to work with our colleagues in Department of Education and in school nutrition to make sure that we all understand correctly whether we are strengthening or weakening nutritional standards for Oregon kids.
And we will do that because we don't have the amendment yet. So.
Okay, I'll be very quick. Sarah Higginbotham with the American Heart Association. One, I just want to point out, I don't think it could be said enough or loud enough, that I want to applaud the Oregon Department of Education and Oregon legislators, past and present, for making Oregon an absolute leader in nutrition standards in our schools around the country. If you didn't know it, we are. We're at the very front lines of this. So one, I want to applaud on that point. I also want to say I'm very happy to see this bill come forward. It is a priority for the American Heart Association to make sure that we legitimize and bring up to speed our nutrition standards with the federal policies. And we support the approach that ODEE has taken, which takes the best of both, the strongest pieces of both the federal and current Oregon statute. I share concern with my colleague at Upstream about the exemption on entrees, standalone entrees. But I apologize that I don't come ready with all the information. I have some questions just about whether it does weaken or does not weaken. And so we'd like to take the time between now and whenever this bill is worked.
Yeah, as soon as we get the amendment, we'll reschedule.
Yep, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. Cassandra, I think we were talking in my office about, do these changes in nutritional standards work? And we don't have time to answer that question right now, but I was still hoping to see some data that says the changes we're making are working.
Right.
We're not just making them so we can feel good. So that's really not a question.
More of a request.
Right.
But I'm still looking forward to seeing that data that tells us this is a good idea.
Okay, we're working on it for you. Thank you
very much. Any other questions? Okay, with that, again, we're going to carry over this, keep this public hearing open, and so we can deal with the amendments. What we're going to do is I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2545. If you could, again, summarize for those of us that, well, I remember what the bill is, because it's mine, but if you could please read
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Summary.
Members of the committee. House Bill 2545 requires school districts to provide lunch free of charge to students who are eligible for reduced price lunches. It directs the Department of Ed to reimburse school districts the actual amount the student have been required to pay. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. It does, there has been a fiscal statement issued for the bill, and it does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Springer. Chair Doherty, I move that House Bill 2545 to the floor be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior referral. Okay, Representative Springer moves House Bill 2545 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to vote yes on this, and it's not even a conflict to do that. There are some concerns that I do have. Ultimately, the kids are victimized in this situation, sometimes by accident and sometimes by the actions of their parents. I would simply ask those parents who are sending their kids to school without lunch money, please consider not smoking or not drinking if that's your situation. Because here we go, in the cradle-to-grave regime here, we're taking care of everybody from beginning to end and taking responsibility that ultimately belongs to parents. And some of them have drawn a bad card. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Some are in great difficulty, and I am more than pleased to take care of the kids in this way. But for those parents who are spending $10 a day on cigarettes and other bad habits, I would just say, please, please consider changing your lifestyle habits, because this is the cost that it inflicts on society when choices like that are made.
Okay, thank you. Quickly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Wilson, and in addition to that, I too am going to be voting yes, but would also just again reiterate that I would hope that districts would do their due diligence in trying to make sure that we use all means possible to utilize the federal funds and get as many folks as we can on the free lunch program first and make sure that we utilize those funds before we tap into the state dollars.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Is there objection? Okay, seeing none, we will take roll call vote, please. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barreto?
Yes.
Representative Hack?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Peluso?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. We will assign this to, actually, I will take this one since it is my bill.
Go to Ways.
Okay?
No carrier.
And so there's no carrier because it goes to Ways and Means. Never mind. Okay, so we close public hearing on House Bill 2545, and motion, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2661.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2661 provides that school drills and instruction on safety threats include lockdown procedures.
Okay.
Am I reading this
one? Yeah.
Chair Doherty, I move that House Bill 2661 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Rep. Frederick's moved.
I mean, I will have.
So. Rep. Frederick moves House Bill 2661 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Reardon.
We had a discussion, I think. Was there a clarification made that this would include, or is there clarification necessary to include lock-in and lock-out procedures?
As it stands, it was going to be a procedure just for at least the way the bill reads, lock-out.
Lockdown.
I just always got confused about those terms, whether we're locking the bad guys out in the community.
The whole purpose behind the bill is the idea to have a drill, so whether you have an active shooter on the premises, whether you have a suspicious person outside of the building, whether you have a police incident within the you know, very close to the schools, anything dealing with that sort of.
I just want to make sure that that's the intent to include all of those. So.
Absolutely. Okay. So it's active shooter and then also a lockdown when they're out.
Thank you.
Representative McLean.
At the school where I was teaching last year, we had that process. We already have that in place. And we didn't know usually if it was in or out as far as, but the procedure is the same. And so it, the lockdown really does cover both the in and out as far as perpetrator. And it we had to use it. It was the first time last year we actually had to use it for a real incident, and I was so glad that we had practiced it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, any other discussion? Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please read the roll?
Representative Hack.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Yes.
Representative Fluzzo.
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Barreto?
Yes.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. I'm going to ask Representative Comp to please carry the bill on the floor. And I will close the work session on 2661. Is there any other business before us? I think not. I adjourn the House Committee on.
Y'all on Friday. Yes. 5 minutes.
Y'all on Friday.
Yes. 5 minutes.